So I mentioned in the work meeting this morning about Jōrikki, which is it's a power or a strength which arises when our mind has been really unified or focused or brought to kind of one-pointedness in meditation. So it's kind of a concentration where the mind starts to become really clear and really still, like water, so that whatever is there can be reflected in that water. I think of our pond, our lake out here, Lake Jorgensen, and when you walk out there on to the lake on it's a very clear day, you see that the mountains are reflected in, and the trees and the clouds and the sky. Everything is reflected in that. So this can be what happens for us through meditation, and it's really more than just concentration in the usual sense of the word concentration. It is in that place of concentration, though, of Jōrikki, that we can begin to see how our minds create dukkha, how discomfort, unease, and unhappiness arises. It's like that still pool of our mind can reflect to us in our thoughts. And so we say dukkha can be seen and can be understood, it can be comprehended. And if we don't see that, and most of the time in our lives our minds are just going on and on about this and that, and we don't know what our mind is doing, when we see it, we see what's coming up, then we have the chance of letting it go. And then the letting go, we don't have to be reactive. We don't have to do something. And what that allows us to is then to really make a choice on how we want to respond, how we want to act in the world. So this pathway has been described many, many times. But honestly, until we experience it for ourselves, it's just words. You know, our mind is so busy commenting all the time on everything that's happening, judging. I like this, I don't like that, criticizing, oh my gosh, did you see what they just did? Oh my God. Or wanting, you know. Man, there hasn't been any sweets on this retreat at all. Yeah. Can't wait to get some mango Häagen-Dazs. So we might see something. Yeah, it's like the aggregate of body is seeing. And we know we've seen this. That's our perception. And then based on that perception, a feeling arises. I like this, I don't like this, or maybe it's just indifference. But then there's a thought that comes in response to that, and it may be conscious or it may be not. You know, I don't like this, so I want to leave. And then based on that, we feel we need to do something. And that's the whole cycle. And it keeps us always running, always doing, always busy. We see something, we hear something, we feel something, we have a thought in response and a reaction. So, for example, we're sitting here and we may start to feel bored. Gosh, how many hours have I been just sitting here? And she keeps saying, listen to the birds, listen to the birds. So we start thinking about going home. And since we start thinking about going home, that leads us to think about, oh, what will we do when we get there? And we leave our present reality completely and we miss what's happening right here. And then tomorrow, we're driving down the road and there's a lot of traffic. And all we can think of is, gosh, I wish I was back at Mountain Lamp with the listening to the birds, the flowering trees, sitting in stillness. You know, there's this endless commentary going on that's judging and criticizing and wanting. And it's most of our lives. It's like we want it to be different. And we go about with these kinds of thoughts all the time, and we don't even know they're happening. And yet they're shaping our experience and our life. So the Buddha said, when a thought arises, we know a thought is there. We see this and we grasp it. We understand it. If it's a judgment, we know it's a judgment. If it's a pleasant thought, we know it's a pleasant thought. And within this practice, we can know when there are thoughts and what those thoughts are. And this doesn't just happen during sitting meditation, although it's during sitting meditation that we are able, the mind clears in such a way that we can see what's going on inside. But much of the thinking begins when we stand up and start moving about. You know, I like this, I don't like this, I'm tired. And in our practice, it's not even that we want to get rid of thoughts, but we want to know them, we want to see them. And in order for that to happen, we have to have settled into some level of stillness and then keep returning there with our focus. And it's why the Buddha offered three primary places of focus. One is our breath, the Anapanasati Sutra, breathing in, I know that I'm breathing in. Breathing out, I know that I'm breathing out. And we know that, but we aren't necessarily saying those words. In fact, it's much better if it is wordless. But we're experiencing it. We are in the midst of that. And the same with awareness of body. We are in our bodies. We are embodied. And with sounds, we're not saying always, oh, there's a bird. But we know that's a bird. That's consciousness. You know, it's like it doesn't have to have words to it. It can just be aware. We can just be aware in that way. So if a thought arises, and even though we may see it, we don't really are conscious of it, then we believe this thought is true. It's me thinking about something outside of me. It's a subject, me, and an object. And there's separation. And we just assume that it's accurate and it's true. And a feeling arises. It might be irritation, it might be frustration, it might even be joy. But it'll be either a feeling we want, in which case we don't ever want it to go away, or it's a feeling we don't want, in which case we want it to go away as fast as we can, as it can, so we put it outside of ourselves. It's because of that person that I feel this way. It's because of this part of the schedule that I don't like that I feel this way. And if we aren't able to let go of the wanting and not wanting, if we aren't able to let go of this belief of me and mine, then some kind of reaction will come up. And the reaction is the basis for an action. And since it's a reaction, there's usually suffering involved. And that's how dukkha arises. If we are able to see this and stop this chain of events at any point, we experience a great sense of relief and freedom. We have sovereignty over ourselves. We have free will. We have choice. Here are the Four Noble Truths embodied. One who has developed some jōriki is no longer a slave to their mind or their passions. And also, we're no longer at mercy of the environment. A while ago, a friend told me about a situation and his practice with it of somebody in the Sangha who sometimes said really unkind things and was a difficult person. And that happens in Sangha sometimes. And, you know, there had been a whole history of him feeling criticized by this person and a lot of reaction to that person and sort of saying, well, I want to stay away from this person who's also a man, him, as much as I possibly can, because he really sets me off and I always feel criticized, and I don't want to be around that person very much. And then one time in Sangha, a while ago, he said that person did something that, you know, that felt really intentional to as a jab towards him, and he felt so much upset and anger. And then he went and he sat, and he did just what the Buddha said to do. Just what came back to his breath as his point of focus, and the anger would come up, and he'd come back, and he was aware of the anger. He knew the story, but he didn't get lost in it or caught in it. He kept coming back, and then the story would come up. He came back, and he just kept coming back, and at the same time allowing the feeling to be there without getting involved in it at all. You know, it was like the present moment was his anchor. But he didn't push anything away either. He didn't reject anything. And in the midst of that, at one point, he said, what came up, and he says, I don't know where this came from, was the thought, how do I live the precept of reconciliation? How do I make peace with this? And he came back to his breath. And, you know, then the evening got over and, you know, people went home and stuff. But he still stayed kind of alive with this. You know, he stayed really aware whenever the thoughts of the story or the situation came up, or any of the old history that had happened many times before with that person came up. You know, he'd come back to his breath, and he'd come back to that question that had arisen within him. And then he said, the next morning, he got up to make tea, and as he was making tea, it was like everything fell away, and his heart was completely at peace, and all the old story had fallen away as well. And he said he didn't know if he'd be reactive again in this situation or not. But at that moment, he felt complete resolution with the past. How did this happen? That's an important point. And then there's two other points about this. First of all, in practicing this way, past, present, and future are all taken care of. The old story, the old history, had dropped away. The resentment from the night before had dropped away. He wasn't sure about the future, but he thought that he knew a way to be able to be in that person's presence and be still maintain clear thinking and open-heartedness. In that moment, past, present, and future were all taken care of. And there's another important point. We don't have to take on the suffering of another person. We don't have to make their suffering our suffering. Because when somebody does that sort of talking meanly about someone behind their back, for example, or confronting somebody, or just doing little jabs, innuendos, you know, we know this, we all know this stuff. And we don't have to take it on. We don't have to make it be ours. And there's a real tendency, you know, I mean, a little bit when we read invoking the Bodhisattva's names today, you know, if we take that as some sort of rules or ideas, we think, well, okay, you know, somebody's suffering. I'm supposed to take on their suffering and take care of it for them. But the fact is, that's just codependent behavior, and it gets us nowhere. it causes more suffering for ourselves and for the other person. And there's really a tendency to do that, that we identify with each other through the suffering, through their suffering. Oh, I'm so sorry, no. And somewhere we've read this week, and I can't remember where, I tried to find it, and I didn't find it, but we read, you know, what we do is we call forth the best in a person. We support people in their best, not in their suffering. But we also don't reject them in their suffering. It means we have to call forth ourselves in our best as well. And we don't have to take on other people's suffering and make it our own. When somebody says something horrible about you behind your back and it gets back to you, you know, it really hurts. And, you know, we practice with it until, you know, we see if there's any truth in it and if we need to shape anything or not. But also staying really clear about, you know, that suffering came to us because of the other person's suffering, and we don't have to take it on. We can let it just stay there with them. And it really helps a lot that way to keep clear of resentment and anger. You know, we hurt each other all the time. And that hurt is an opportunity for us to find our own sovereignty and our own freedom. I've sort of gotten into Wendell, I mean, I've been into Wendell Berry for a long time, but for some reason, Wendell Berry's poems have kept jumping out to me this week. So here's one from Sabbaths. I go among trees and sit still. All my stirring becomes quiet around me like circles on water. My tasks lie in their places where I left them, asleep like cattle. But then what is afraid of me comes and lives a while in my sight. What it fears in me leaves me, and the fear of me leaves it. It sings and I hear its song. Then what I am afraid of comes, I live for a while in its sight. What I fear in it leaves me, and the fear of it leaves me. It sings and I hear its song. After days of labor, mute in my consternations, I hear my song at last and I sing it. As we sing, the day turns, the trees move. Practice is a process of coming to know our experience. And we can't really know our experience if we're just lost drifting around in our thoughts, our feelings. We need to be able to engage with our breath, our body, and sound in such a way that when thoughts arise, we know they are there. And we know what they are. When feelings arise, we know that they are there, and we know what they are. In the Anapanasati Sutra, it says, breathing in, I know I'm breathing in a long breath. Breathing out, I know I am breathing out a long breath. And it's just that simple experience of our breath and our consciousness that allows us to see and acknowledge it and to know our experience. It's not a technique, But it does take a conscious effort to pay attention. When we hear the dog barking, we know the dog is barking, but we don't have to put words to it. We just are aware that we hear it. Earlier this afternoon, there were some gunshots. There's a gravel pit across the way that local people come and practice target shooting. And if a gunshot is there, and it's just the pure sound, we don't have our associations with it, or our reaction to it, our thoughts. It's just boom. Boom. Nothing more. I'm used to sleeping in a very quiet place. And sometimes when I go to a city, there'll be a lot of noise, highway noise. And it used to be highway traffic would keep me awake, and I'd be really irritated because my sleep was being disturbed. And then I was going to be grumpy the next day because I wasn't going to get a good enough sleep. Yada, yada, yada. You know the story, how it goes on and on, right? But when I dropped my associations with the traffic sound, with being in the city, when I dropped all my reactions, and it was just the sound, what came up was water flowing. When I didn't say, that is a lot of cars going by and going down that long road from there, just dropped it all. It was just not irritating at all, and I slept very well. Our practice is to see through our thoughts, because our thoughts create our reality. And we see through them, we see they have no substance at all. And the same with our senses, our feelings, our perceptions. And again, I say it is necessary to experience this. And to experience this, you need some stillness in your being. It's this way there's a meeting of a self that allows us to see through the self. So a lot of our reactions to situations, I think, come from that genetically programmed response of fight or flight. And they also come from the specific habits that were formed by our early experiences, specific habit energies. When we're judged, we might get angry, or we might withdraw. We might fall into self-criticism, self-judgment. But if it was only genetics and sort of psychological programming, I guess you would say, or the early traumas of our life, that was causing us to be in reaction, we would say we have no free will at all. We'd have no choice. So again, I ask, how is this so? How is it possible that we have free will? We have ability to choose? I want to start by speaking about this with an intellectual understanding. I think something that we can grasp with our intellectual mind. Thay calls it interbeing. I mean, the problem of our fixation on this body as ourselves, when in fact we know that, we are always taking in the world. We're not separate from the world. the environment is always becoming us. Air is becoming us. Water is becoming us. The earth is becoming us. The sun is becoming us. We can all understand that intellectually. And it's helpful to understand it intellectually a little bit because it loosens some of our identity with the separate body. We can do the same with feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. In Buddhism, they say this is because that is. One thing leads to another. It's called conditioned arising. Because the sun is shining on the ocean, there is evaporation and clouds form. And because of the clouds, there are winds that blow the clouds to the land. And because there are mountains, the clouds drop their rain into the rivers, which then flows back to the mountains. One thing leads to another thing. Things are interdependent and all related, interrelated. And that's true about everything. Nothing is separate. Consciousness is not static. I really like this as an idea, that consciousness changes over time, you know, both for us as individuals, but also in the culture and in the history of the world. And as consciousness changes, so does the world. One example is the relationship with nature. You know, native peoples always saw that there was spirit in everything. You know, spirit in the trees, spirit in the water, spirit in the animals. And those spirits, you know, influenced us and were part of us. But then when people needed settled down and became pastoral and farmers, they needed to have some control over nature. Because if a crop failed, you know, the town would die, the people would die. And so it became important that in that having some control, we separated ourselves. We made sort of firm houses where we could have a little bit of fire, we could cook our food, and we made a little separation from nature. And then in the Renaissance, and then further in the Renaissance, it was, you know, Descartes saying, you know, I think, therefore I am, and that is like mind over matter, and that then got applied basically to create the Industrial Revolution. You know, where we took a lot more control over nature, over illness, we got a lot safer, but we also got a lot more further away. And it's continued into our modern times where, you know, really mind and matter are separate, are two different things. They are objectified reality. And science has done that, has objectified reality. And through all of these changes in our conscious way of thinking about the world, our relationship to nature has changed. And we've become more and more separate from it. We are now distinct from the great surround. And there's an incredible loneliness for all of us in that. We seem to be completely independent of nature now. And yet, you know, our lives are more safe, more protected, perhaps. But also, in many ways, this has led to the abuse of nature, the destroying of nature, this objectifying, this separation. And it also has led to the abuse of peoples, other peoples. with the understanding of codependent arising and interbeing as a conscious way, an intellectual way of looking at the world, we can begin to understand some healing, I think. I think there's an evolution happening. You know, there's also a real interesting corollary, I think, with the human development. And, you know, when a baby is born, they're completely at one with the mother. There's no separation at all. The spirit of the mother and the spirit of the baby are the same. And then, bit by bit, an individual ego begins to develop, and the child starts to separate from first the mother, and then from parents going to and starting to have other, you know, teachers and other people important in their lives, and more separation from that place of oneness with the first the mother and then the family. And that continues, you know, until we really develop a completely independent identity as an adult. And I think we go through periods where, you know, where we feel very, very alone and on our own and having to do it by ourselves, for ourselves. And I think except for some philosophers and for poets and for mystics, that separation is pretty complete. And there's a gradual searing from that place of identity, of oneness. And we no longer participate in the other, at least that's what we think. But of course we do. It's just we lose our consciousness of it. But these are necessary evolutions that are happening. And I believe there's more evolution happening now. Moving towards more of an understanding of our unity. There is much more connection globally among peoples. Something that happened this week that you guys don't know about, and I don't know much about, but there were some papers released called the Panama Papers that have exposed a firm in Panama that was laundering huge, huge, huge quantities of money for the very richest, most powerful people in the world. And it's implicated almost most of the big leaders in the world. Mm-hmm. And the way it happened was somebody leaked, nobody knows who it was, to two German journalists, 11.5 million documents. And it was so much, they said, we cannot do this by ourselves. So we cannot go through this. We cannot comprehend this. We cannot work with this. So they went to this group of journalists, 11 journalists who sort of oversee justice issues and said, we've got this. Can you help us with it? And they said, yeah, we can. And they looked at it and said, this is too much for us. And so they began getting journalists from all over the world involved in this very highly competitive world of journalism where you're always trying to scoop everyone else. All of these peoples working together agreed to not publish anything on their own, but to wait and till everything was sorted through and understood and then it all be published at the exact same day everywhere in the world. A couple of days ago. I know, so that's That's, I mean, just sort of a heartwarming story. You know, another not so heartwarming story that we are also very much aware of is global warming. And that's, you know, it's like nobody is safe from that. You know, we are all one together in this. As much as we try to think I can somehow do something to protect myself, the fact is we are all in this together. And we are being asked to wake up. Whatever that consciousness is, that evolution of consciousness, we are being asked to wake up. In our spiritual practice of focusing beyond, into, and through thought, feelings, perceptions, you know, we come to see that this consciousness of separation, it's not real. That it has no power in the way, and it only obstructs us. And so we begin to let go and touch no mind, no thought. And we forget ourselves. We sit as cherry blossom. We sit as birdsong. And our idea of self, other, inside, outside, subject, object, all fall away. And the universe comes forth illuminated and whole and in mysterious union. This is why even our genetic programming over millions of years has no real power. Because there is something deeper and more true that is supporting us and giving rise to all potential that has no time, not past, not present, not future, that takes no space, that is impermanent, along with matter, always changing, but never separate. This is why when we practice in the midst of a difficulty, coming back to our breath, not getting swept away, but not pushing it away, eventually in that place of still openness, something else will arise. The question we need to ask. And it's because we are supported always by something much greater than ourselves. And when we ask a question, it is this reality that we give ourselves over to, and it is always there to meet us. Once we've let go of our ideas of permanence, satisfactoriness, and belonging to me. In the early 80s, when Jack and I were at Maui Zendo, Yamada Roshi, who is Eika Roshi's teacher, came to visit. And we had a little Sangha gathering, like this, in the library at the Zendo. And, you know, just talking with Yamada Roshi. And it was during the height of the nuclear buildup that was happening. And Russia and and the United States, we were both building up lots and threatening each other a lot. And someone asked Jamada Roshi, you know, what'll happen if we destroy everything? We blow up the world. There's a nuclear war. And he said that, you know, there will still be an essence. They won't be destroyed. The seeing into that essence is the heart of the Buddha way. And it is the great optimism of Buddhism. When we see into this reality, it comes with a responsibility, an important obligation. To whatever is given to us to do, we do it with our full presence. Whether it is to be a teacher, a doctor, whether it is to weed the garden, whether it is to play the piano, write poems, we give ourselves fully to that task. And in this way, we continue the evolution of consciousness from which our world, the world we live in, arises. In this realization, there is no birth, there is no death, there is no coming, there is no going. There is no past, present, or future. Tori Zenji said, absolutely silent, and yet illuminating in a mysterious way. We bring forth this mind so that we and all beings become mature in Buddha's wisdom. We can trust this great mystery that is who we are. We can trust this great unfolding that we are a part of. And it's very important to realize that, because that allows us to trust ourselves. Trust our practice, and trust each other. We never know what's going to happen. But we know we're part of something that is blessed and blessed. And when we give ourselves to this, that becomes the evolution of consciousness. Blessings.